Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Thank you for making time to be here. It's Friday night, and I know there's other things college students can do on Friday night, so I'm really grateful for you making time to be here. And also, I want to celebrate in advance a little bit something that's coming up on March 7th. Does anyone know what happens on March 7th of this year? Well, sort of, yeah. It's the 750th anniversary of the death of St. Thomas Aquinas. So it is a day to celebrate his entrance into eternal life. And today I'm going to be talking very much in the spirit of Aquinas, but I don't think I'm going to say too much about Aquinas himself. And the reason I say I'm going to be speaking in the spirit of Aquinas is that I would say his fundamental insight was the harmony between faith and reason, that faith and reason are like two wings that allow us to fly up towards a greater and greater understanding of the truth. And the reason I think this is important for today's talk is that I'm going to be talking a lot about psychology. And many people in their minds think of psychology and faith as sort of enemies. And there's a good reason for this, that the founder of modern psychology, Sigmund Freud, was an atheist who viewed religion very much in a suspect light. And he thought of it as infantile. He thought that once we grew up, we would outgrow our need for God and that we were better off if we grew out of relying on God. So this was very much part of Freud's understanding of psychology. But of course, things have changed a lot since the death of Sigmund Freud. So today I want to talk a little bit about psychology, philosophy, theology, and happiness. And you might wonder how I got into talking about this. And I got into this, well, I'll tell you a little story. This was 15 years ago, I guess. I got a new job, and it was in Washington, D.C. at the Catholic University of America. It was being director of the honors program there. And I was really excited about this job. It was like a 40% pay raise. And I thought, well, that's great. And I'm going to be a big shot on the academic leadership team with the provost and the deans and all this. So I thought, oh, great, I'm going to be a big shot. And I made great friends at this place in a great parish, St. John the Beloved in McLean, Virginia. Anyway, just fantastic. Things are so great. But there was one huge problem. My wife hated Washington, D.C., completely hated it. And I was, you know, and I loved it. As much as she hated it, I loved it. So, you know, we had this huge disagreement, and we argued about it and talked about it and tried to figure it out. And I thought, this is not going anywhere. It's just like, you know, immovable object and an irresistible force or something going around and around. So I thought, okay, I've got to bring in God. So I start praying, you know, God, please grant that my wife will like living in Washington, D.C. Please, God, grant that she'll make nice friends here and she'll, you know, have a group of people she really connects with. And kept praying, nothing. No change at all in my wife. So this is about 2 months go by. I thought, okay, I've got to really step up my game. So I pretended it was Lent. It's like, okay, I'm going to do sacrifices. I'm going to make, you know, really, really. And I got my friends to pray and praying, nothing. And I go, okay, well, I got to help God out a little bit. So I went to my wife and I said, honey, you know, I've been praying for you. I've been praying that God will make it so that you really love being here in Washington, D.C. And she said to me, well, that's very interesting. Did you ask God what God wants? And I said, no, I didn't do that. So I was afraid to ask God what God wanted, because I did not want the answer to be, you're going to go back to Los Angeles. And so for about 3 weeks, I would not pray about this at all. And then finally, after about 3 weeks, I thought to myself, well, you know, God is all loving. God is all wise. And maybe I should just check in and just maybe see, you know, do a little consulting or something. So anyway, I finally got the courage up to pray and ask God what God wanted. And I don't know, I felt very convicted that God did want us to go back to Los Angeles. So we packed everything up, and I gave up the 40% raise and gave up the academic leadership thing and gave up friends I loved and gave up the parish I loved and move back to Los Angeles, and I'd be lying if I said when I got back to Los Angeles I was delighted. I wasn't. I was very depressed. I was miserable. I thought I finally had, for a year, the life I always wanted, and now it's completely gone. So I was really devastated. I was really very upset. And so since I'm a scholar, I did what every good scholar would do when you have a problem. I went to Google, and I said, how do I become more happy? Press click. And up arose all this stuff that I'd never heard about, this whole new field of psychology called positive psychology. And it was founded in about the year 2000 by a professor at the University of Pennsylvania named Martin Seligman. And basically what he pointed out to his fellow psychologists is that for years, psychology had focused on the negative. So depression, anxiety, you know, problematic traumas that you go through, all these kind of negative things. And psychology really had not spent much time at all talking about thriving, optimism, recovery from trauma, happiness, all this stuff just wasn't studied empirically. And so he challenged his fellow psychologists. He said, hey, the other thing, the negative is important, we have to study that too, but let's also spend at least some time looking at the other end of the human experience, the positive. And so that's what positive psychology set out to do. So for the last 25 years almost, they have been investigating, using empirical techniques as they do for medication with double-blind studies, what sorts of things actually do lead to happiness. And one of the first things that I learned from positive psychology was about the importance of gratitude. So here's something anyone here can do if they want, tonight, if they want. Just write down any three things that you're grateful for that happened today. Could be a little thing, like I just had a fantastic salmon dinner. It was super good. So thankful for that. Or I just drove from LA and I made it here safely, no accidents. So I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful for the very kind words you said to me at the beginning of the talk. So I'm thankful for that. So you just think about three, four things in your day. Normal things, it doesn't have to be I won the lottery or the most amazing thing in the world happened. Just normal everyday things that you're grateful for. And what the positive psychology folks found is that people that do this have significant relief from symptoms of depression. And I also realized something else. I thought, you know, I've heard of this gratitude stuff before somewhere. Where have I heard this stuff before? And I thought, oh yeah, there was a guy named St. Ignatius Loyola who founded the Jesuit order. And he advised all the people coming to him for spiritual direction to do what he called the examine. And the examine is, you, at the end of your day, you think about how your day went, and you think about what gifts God has given you in that day. Three, four, five things that God has given you that day. That's part of the examen of St. Ignatius Loyola. So I thought, well, that isn't that interesting? So the positive psychology folks, you know, most of these are secular psychologists. A lot of them are agnostic, atheists. And yet they found this kind of overlap. I thought that was kind of interesting. And I thought, well, you know, even beyond St. Ignatius Loyola, gratitude is a huge part of our Catholic tradition, our Christian tradition. So in the United States, on what day do you think in the United States the fewest people commit suicide? Suicide rates get to their lowest of the whole year.
Christmas?
Not Christmas.
Easter.
Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving Day. The lowest of the whole year. Now, why is that? Well, I think on Thanksgiving, more than most days, people in the United States think about not just what they want and this went wrong or whatever, they think about what they're grateful for. And we as Catholics are very lucky because we have Thanksgiving Day not just once a year. We have Thanksgiving Day every Sunday, if you want, even more than once a week, because every Mass is a Thanksgiving. The Mass is also sometimes called the Eucharist, and Eucharist is just a Greek term for Thanksgiving. So every single Mass is an opportunity to give thanks to God. In fact, those are the very last words of every Mass, right? Thanks be to God. Those are the last words that we say as the Mass is ending. So Thanksgiving is a huge part of our Catholic tradition. So, okay, positive psychology, interesting, okay. Kept on reading in positive psychology. I found they said that forgiveness is absolutely key for happiness. Oh, have I heard that before somewhere? Oh, yeah, I have, actually. How about right in the middle of the Our Father, right? Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. How about forgiveness was one of the very last things Jesus said as he was dying on the cross? One of the seven last sayings that he gave to us. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. And why is forgiveness so important? Well, forgiveness is so important because without forgiveness, you cannot have any long-term relationships. You can't. Why? Well, because any long-term relationship, whether it's a spouse or a friend or a child or a parent or whatever, at some point, whoever it is going to do or say something that makes you upset, that hurts your feelings, that was the wrong thing to say, that was just they were having a bad day and they snapped at you, or who knows? And if you don't have forgiveness, you say, that's it, I'm not talking to him anymore. We're not friends, forget it, you're out here. Oh, Mom, you did this, this Christmas gift was terrible. I'm not talking to you anymore, that's it, it's over. My dad, oh, he did this thing to me, I don't talk to him anymore. My brother, my sister, everybody, you'll be totally without any long-term friendships or relationships of any kind if you don't practice forgiveness. And the positive psychology folks did this huge study on the nature of well-being and happiness. And what they found is the key to happiness is love. It's called the Grant study. These, you know, huge long study, you know, what's the key variables, education, this, that, the other thing. No, the key thing for human flourishing was love. In fact, their lead researcher summarized this huge study by saying, happiness is love, full stop. And I thought again, God, where have I heard about this before? Love, the importance of love. Oh, I know, I have heard of this before, right? This is obviously central to the whole Christian message, right? I can have faith to move mountains. I can give my body over to be burned. But none of this matters if I don't have love. Love is the key and the highest of all the virtues, according to Thomas Aquinas, St. Paul, the whole Christian tradition. So I kept on discovering these commonalities and these themes, and I thought, this is really, really interesting. And the more I read in positive psychology, the more I found that these researchers were kind of reinventing the wheel. They were discovering things that were already part of our tradition, but providing an empirical basis for believing in the efficacy of these things. In other words, there's now good empirical grounds for forgiving others, good empirical grounds for being grateful, and good empirical grounds for serving other people. One of the studies Seligman did with his students was he divided his students into two groups. Into one group, he said, I want you to do a fun activity. So go to the movies, go eat some ice cream, go do something fun. This would be great. Go off, have some fun. The other group, he said, I want you to do some altruistic activity. So maybe go to an old folks home and maybe, you know, be nice and cheerful and, you know, with the old people and visit with them so they're not lonely. Or maybe go into a school and help the little kids learn how to read. Just do some altruistic activity. And what he found was this. Both groups reported a big boost in positive emotion. But the positive emotions of those who went for ice cream and movies was short-lived, whereas the positive emotions of people who visited the elderly or helped the kids learn to read was much, much longer, more lasting positive emotion. So again, this seems very clearly something central to our Catholic tradition, right? Especially during Lent. Lent is all about what? Prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. And what is almsgiving? Almsgiving can be giving money to people, but the corporal works of mercy are all ways of almsgiving. So what I mean is, anytime you're really serving and helping other people, this is a way, a corporal work of mercy or a spiritual work of mercy. And we're all called to do this. Again, each in our own way. Maybe for some people it is donating money. Maybe for other people, if you're a poor student, you probably don't have much money to donate. But you might have time to donate, and so you could visit elderly people. Elderly people love to be visited. They really do. You go there and just be friendly and be nice and listen to their stories and listen to them complain about this and that and hold their hand if they want to hold your hand and show them that you care, that they exist. And some people are so lonely, and for someone to make a difference and show up on a regular basis and befriend them and be kind to them is going to really make a positive difference in their life. So, positive psychology seems to be rediscovering the wheel. And yet, if you could do all these positive psychology things with no faith at all, I mean, you could be an atheist and be grateful, right? You could be an atheist and work at a soup kitchen or visit old people or go teach kids to read. You could be a person who has no faith at all and do the things I've talked about. Right? Love your neighbor, serve people, you could do all that. So what does Christianity add that positive psychology doesn't really account for. Well, one thing it adds is lasting meaning. So what I mean is, if we think of meaning as making a contribution to the well-being of those that are beyond us, if God doesn't exist, well, there really is no meaning that lasts beyond our lifetime. Because if we're a fantastically beautiful and good person like Mother Teresa, or if we're just a terrible tyrant and killing people, either way, the people we harm or benefit are going to die, and then eventually even the knowledge or the memory of what we did or what they suffered or how they benefited, that's going to go away. So in the end, in terms of a more lasting perspective, it doesn't really, there's no lasting effects of this. Unless God knows and God cares, and there is a kind of everlasting dimension to the temporal everyday things that we do. Positive psychology also doesn't do anything about guilt. So what I mean is, psychology can help us a lot with feelings of guilt. But there's a difference between feelings of guilt and the reality of guilt. Just like there's a difference between having a toothache and having a cavity, right? You could have a cavity and not have it ache, not have a feeling of it, right? So psychology can help us deal with negative emotions and negative feelings, but they can take away the feelings of guilt, perhaps, or diminish them, but they can't take away guilt itself. But guilt is actually a reality. Everyone, whether you're a believer or not a believer, everyone recognizes that they do things that are wrong. And for many people, they carry around this burden of guilt for years, even decades, knowing that they did wrong and not having a way of kind of undoing that. But we as Catholics are extremely lucky because we do, right? We have a way of undoing the guilt, and it's called confession. And this season of Lent is a fantastic time to take advantage of that sacrament. Maybe you haven't gone in a long time. That's okay. That's okay. My father-in-law, his name's Dennis, and he came out as gay in about 1971. And so when my wife was a little girl, like, he left the family and he moved to New York City. And so basically my wife had this kind of difficult relationship with him. He had kind of a prickly personality and they didn't really get along. Anyway, my wife really made a great effort to, you know, to reach out to him and try to be a good daughter. And I think, honestly, she was kind of heroic, because I think there'd be a lot of daughters who just would have said, forget it. If you're going to act like this, I'm not going to have anything to do with you. But she didn't. She really honored her father in a very serious way. Anyway, we didn't see much of Dennis for a long time because we live in Los Angeles and he was living in New York. But then for a year, we moved to Princeton. And so Princeton and New York City aren't far away. And so we would go into New York City about every 3 weeks or so and see Dennis and his legal husband, Claudio. And, you know, they have very different political and religious views than we did. So we just didn't talk about that much and just kept it light and be civil and be friendly. Anyway, as the year went on, Dennis got kind of sicker and sicker. And then he came to realize that he was dying. And so came time for us to move back to Los Angeles. The year at Princeton was over. And then Dennis and Claudio were going to move to Uruguay, because that's where Claudio was from. So we came to our last kind of goodbye. We were on the sidewalk there and they helped us. They gave us a few mementos to remember Dennis by and stuff. And so we said goodbye to them. And Claudio said to me, he said, Chris, I was terrified to meet you. He said, I'm gay, I'm an atheist, and I'm a Jew. And I thought you would hate me, but you have not been anything but loving and kind to me. And, you know, I thank him for the kind words. And then, you know, Dennis and Jennifer gave their last, you know, hug goodbye and said goodbye. So we moved back to Los Angeles and they moved to Uruguay. And, you know, Jennifer kept in touch with her dad through the phone, and pretty soon it became clear that he was really close to dying. And so we'd be talking to the nurse, and the nurse would be like, he's going to die like in the next week. And so I said to Jennifer, I said, well, do you think maybe your dad would allow a priest to come in and give him last rites? I know it's been over 50 years that he has had any contact with the church at all, but, you know, okay, I'll ask him. So she calls him up on the phone and he says, I don't need last rites. I'm not dying. The nurse just told us like the day before he's going to die in a week. Okay. And so I said to Jennifer, I whispered to her, I said, well, just ask me if he wants anointing of the sick. Have a priest pray with him. Oh yeah, I'll do that. Okay, fine. Anointing of the sick and priest praying with me. I'll do that. That's fine. So anyway, I called a friend who knew a priest in Uruguay. Priest went over there and heard his confession. first in over 50 years, gave him last rites, gave him his last Holy Communion. And the last picture we have of him, he's holding a crucifix that the priest gave him. And the nurse told us that he wouldn't let go of it, so she'd washed his whole body, and he'd have to wash his hands around it because he wouldn't let go of it. So if you've been away for a confession, even as long as my father-in-law, 50 years, that's even more reason to go. And you never have anything to fear. Priests are absolutely 100% bound, never, ever, under any circumstances, to reveal in any way whatsoever anything that you say to them in confession. So you can be brutally and completely honest. And you can let go of any guilt that you're carrying around. Right? Because we all make garbage. Right? We're human beings. You eat a banana, you got a banana peel left over. Look, this is just being human. It's going to happen to you. But we have a way of taking out the garbage rather than having the banana peels and this all the garbage carrying around in a bag, carrying all, you know, for weeks and months and years. So, positive psychology doesn't give us any answer for the real problem of guilt, the reality of guilt. And so you might say, well, look, if Christianity gives us all the good things positive psychology gives us, plus other things like relief of guilt, like a relationship with God, well, why aren't all Christian people super happy all the time? I mean, is every single Christian, like super happy all the time? Well, probably not. You probably know some grumpy people that seem to be people of faith. I got a big frown on their face and having a bad day all the time, it seems like. Now, how do you explain this if what I've said is true? Well, I think we can't explain this. So one thing to understand about happiness is that, at least according to the positive psychology folks, people are born with a genetic orientation towards greater or lesser happiness. Or to put it differently, people can be born kind of dour, gloomy, downbeat, kind of negative, kind of looking on the dark side of things, just as a matter of their genetics. So it could be the case that some grumpy Christian you know would be even more grumpy if it weren't for practicing faith. Another thing is that some people who are Christians actually don't do a very good job of practicing what Jesus preaches. So imagine I go to the doctor and say, doctor, I'm having lots of problems breathing. I got this asthma, I can't breathe. And the doctor's like, great, here's Cerevent, here's Flovent. You got to take two puffs in the morning, two at night. Here's the medication. Take it. Oh, thanks, doctor. Great, great. And I go home, and I put the medication behind the mirror, and I never take it. And then I still have breathing problems. Well, yeah, you didn't do what the doctor ordered. So if Jesus orders us to forgive others and we don't forgive, we're going to be less happy. If Jesus orders us to love and serve others and we don't love and serve others, we're going to be less happy. If Jesus tells us to pray and we don't pray, we're going to be less happy. If Jesus tells us to confess and we don't confess, we're going to be less happy. So there are many people that are in church who haven't yet fully followed the doctor's orders. They haven't yet really, you know, carried out the kinds of acts that Jesus wants us to carry out. A third explanation for grumpy Christians has to do with a reality that whether you're a Christian or an atheist or an agnostic or a Buddhist or a Muslim or whatever your faith is, you have a vulnerability to both physical and mental illness. If I get into a car accident today on the way home and I break, you know, half my bones in my body, I'm going to be unhappy. It's going to hurt like crazy. I'm going to be sad and crying in the hospital. It's going to stink, right? So being a person of faith obviously doesn't make you Superman, where you're not going to get physically injured or hurt. But getting physically injured and hurt can hamper our happiness. Likewise, being a person of faith doesn't immunize you against mental illness, against depression, against anxiety. Now, it is true there is psychological research that people of faith who practice their faith, who go to church, have lower rates of depression and lower rates of anxiety and lower rates of abuse of drugs and alcohol. True. But you can be a person of faith, of deep faith, and still have mental health issues. Now, if you have mental health issues, if you have physical health issues, you're going to be less happy than if you don't. And if you have very serious mental and physical health issues, you might be significantly less happy than you would be if you didn't have these kinds of problems. So yes, of course, there are some Christian people, even good Christian people, who still are suffering from unhappiness, depression, anxiety, because they have physical and or mental health problems and challenges and difficulties, which, regardless of your faith, is going to bring you down. The biggest problem, I think, for Christians not having as much happiness as they could be would be sin, wrongdoing. Our happiness, if it's true that our happiness consists in love, which is something even the secular psychologists believe, then when we fail to love properly, we're going to fail to have the happiness we could. That is, if we fail to love God properly, if we fail to love other people properly, or even if we fail to love ourselves properly, all those are going to be obstacles to our own happiness. And yes, fail to love ourselves properly. Some people forget about this. You should love yourself. Why? Well, we're supposed to love all human beings, right? And you're a human being, so you should love yourself. You should take care of yourself, right? Take care of your physical well-being. Take care of your body by exercise and not abusing drugs and alcohol and, you know, doing the kinds of things you need to do to be a healthy person. And this is also a way of loving others. If I take care of myself physically, for instance, and in terms of my mental health, is it not true that I'll be a better father, a better husband, a better professor, a better friend? It's really hard to care and love for others if you're yourself not doing very well. So loving yourself is not selfish. There's a difference between selfishness versus authentic and genuine caring for yourself, because you are a human being. And so you should be cared for. You should be loved. And love starts at home. So you love yourself. You love especially those that are close to you, right? Your mom and your dad, your grandma and grandpa. How much joy would you give them if you called them, you know, once a week? Your grandparents might be lonely. They may not receive many visitors or calls, or, and I'm guessing if they're like 99.99% of grandparents, they love their grandchildren. So to get a call from you, a visit from you, is going to really make their day, right? Or for older people, their parents, if they're still around. This is a beautiful way to love others. So Aquinas's idea is that love ought to start at the home. In other words, love should be most intense for those that are most closely related to us. So in my case, since I'm married, I should have a special love for my wife and my kids. And everybody, I should love everybody, but especially my wife and my kids. I shouldn't love you more than I love my own son. I should love you, but not as much as my own son. So love is a little bit like a fire. In a fire, it gives the most light and the most heat to whoever is closest to it. And each one of us should be a fire wherever we are, giving light, heat, compassion, mercy, generosity, kindness to whoever it is that's around us. You know, our students, our colleagues, people in the neighborhood, whoever it is around us should feel the light and heat that comes from us. You could liken us to a mirror, right? And the mirror can reflect the sun, right? If the sun's up there, and I can reflect that. And we can reflect God's light and God's love and God's mercy and God's compassion on everybody that we come into contact with. And that's ideally what we should do if we're people of faith. We should try to have that light and that love flow through us. But we don't always do that. Sometimes our mirror is dirty. Sometimes the mirror's not focused. Sometimes we're just out to lunch. And I speak for myself as the first person in all those categories of many days. So sin is a problem getting in the way of our happiness, and obviously getting in the way of the happiness of others. Because when we're sinful, it isn't just what I alone do. Almost always, in fact, always, it bleeds over into others. Hurting their feelings, taking time away from them, just making myself into the kind of person that's not as good a person for other people. And Aquinas thought there were three causes of sin. He thought there was malice, ignorance, and weakness of will. And I'm guessing for most of you, you probably don't sin out of malice very often. I doubt when you do something bad, you're like, I don't care, I'm doing this, and rawr, and you're just like this malicious person, being mean to people just to be mean or something. Maybe you are, but probably not. And probably when you sin, it typically isn't a matter of pure ignorance either, right? Like, I had no idea drinking 20 beers was wrong. What do you mean? I had no idea about that. No, I think you know. So I think the problem for most people is weakness of will. So I want to conclude my remarks today by talking about some discoveries in positive psychology about how to strengthen willpower, how to help us gain greater willpower. So if we gain greater willpower, we can hopefully not fall into weakness of will as often. So what does the positive psychology research show? Well, the idea is something like this. Willpower is a little bit like a muscle. And if you want to strengthen your muscles, what do? You go to the gym. You hit the weights. You exercise. And if we want to have greater willpower, we should exercise our willpower. And this season of Lent is a fantastic time. It's a custom-made season to strengthen your willpower. So it's a time of doing things that are challenging. A 40-day challenge, you might say, right? To grow. And so what can we do? You might have, when you were a little kid, be like, I'm not eating M&Ms. I'm not eating Skittles. No, that's fine, you know, when you're 10. But I don't. This doesn't look like anyone here is 10. So what's an adult's way to take up Lent? Well, here's something you could try. How about no alcohol all Lent? Not one sip of one beer, including Sundays. That's a good one. That's a good one. That might challenge you a little bit. Might be good. You might find, after you don't drink for a while, that actually you feel better. You feel more powerful. You feel more loving. You feel more in control of yourself. I don't know if you've ever listened to Andrew Huberman. He's a Stanford medical doctor, podcaster. He has a 2.5-hour podcast about the effects of alcohol. And I've listened to this podcast, and 2 hours and 13 minutes of it are about the negative effects of alcohol. And there's about 2 minutes, like one study found that it could maybe a little bit help your heart, maybe. Everything else was negative. Anyway, so I stopped drinking. I haven't had a drink since September 11th. I feel much better. This has been a huge positive thing in my life. Not like I was a big wino before, but I do. I feel much better. So I'm not telling you what to do. It's your choice. It's your life. But Lent is a good time to experiment with a positive change like this. So that's an adult penance. No alcohol all Lent. Here's another adult penance. Why don't you take a regular shower? And at the end of the shower, just put it on pure cold for about a minute. That's crazy. I can't do that. That's insane. What are you talking about? This is nuts. All right. I'm going back to Huberman. He's a Stanford medical doctor. Is it at Stanford Medical School? He has a whole 2-hour thing on cold exposure. It's not bad for you at all. It's good for you. Lots of positive benefits for cold exposure. So you can try that during Lent if you want to. What else could you do as an adult penance for Lent? How about every single Sunday you do a corporal work of mercy? You volunteer at a soup kitchen. You go visit people in the retirement home. You go to do some kind of hands-on service with people in need. Just on Sunday, it doesn't have to take up your whole day, but an hour, let's say, of some real service to people in need. That is a good adult Lenten practice to grow. How about you take up a new prayer practice, right? Maybe you say the rosary. Maybe you never said that before. You could try it out. Every day during Lent, I'll say the rosary. So again, I'm not telling you what to do. It's your life. It's your relationship with God. Do whatever you think God wants you to do. I don't know what's best for you. I'm just throwing out ideas. But I do think that, at least I'll speak for myself, I treated Lent, even when I was in my 20s, as if I were still, you know, an 8-year-old. And I don't think, you know, I don't think someone in their 20s should act like they're 8. You're in your 20s. You're an adult. You can get married. You can join the military. You can vote. You can give up something a little tougher than some Skittles. Unless you're addicted to Skittles, in which case, Skittles is great if you're addicted. So the positive psychology folks say, if you want more willpower, exercise willpower. Do something against the grain, right? Not putting butter on your bread, not putting sugar in your coffee. Just, it doesn't have to be you're sitting on top of a pole calling attention to yourself. No, you're doing something that's could be very little, but something that you have to kind of work to do. Another thing that strengthens willpower are habits with sleep. So if you want to have good willpower, you need to get enough sleep. It's going to be very hard for you to have good willpower if you're up at 3 a.m, drinking Red Bulls, playing video games. It's not going to work. I'm talking to you. No. You're like, how did you see us last night?
Literally. It's his birthday, by the way.
All right. On your birthday, you can do it. But again, that is again, something that helps you to have more willpower is to get a good night's sleep, right? Get a good night's sleep. Eat healthy food. Exercise. Right? Caring for yourself in these sorts of basic ways will help you have more willpower, and they'll help you in another way. Because if you're a student, right now is the prime time of your life to develop your mind. And everybody here is going to serve through their mind. I don't think anyone here is going to be digging ditches as a way of, you know, making a living. And this is the time to develop your mind as much as you can. And therefore, if you develop your mind as much as you can, you'll be of much greater service to people. I mean, think about, you know, a lawyer who really knows the law backwards and forward, in and out. That person could be a fantastic defense attorney. Or a doctor who really knows medicine super well. They can really help sick people that come to them. And all of us are going to be in jobs where we're going to serve people, again, not so much by physical strength, but by our minds. So the more we know, the more we can help people. And if you get good sleep, and you eat properly, and do all those things, you're going to be able to learn more, and therefore be much better able to serve and help others. Another thing about willpower is fighting the bear. What am I talking about, fighting the bear? So let's say you have a temptation, right? I want you right now, we'll just practice, we'll do it right now. I want you not to think about white bears. Okay. No one think about white bears. Okay, go ahead. How are you doing? You successfully not thinking about white bears? Now, I'm guessing none of you were thinking about white bears at all until I started talking about white bears, and now you can't get white bears out of your mind. So when temptations come along, and of course they will, think about it like a white bear. Now, what do you want to do if a bear comes in your campground? Well, there's two things you don't want to do. Thing one you don't want to do is fight the white bear. You don't go out there and push the white bear over and try to fight it, right? Because you're going to get clobbered, right? So that doesn't really work. What else doesn't work? Feeding the white bear. So you say, fine, the bear's here, I'll give him some food. And he'll eat the food and he'll go away. Well, yeah, if you give him food, he'll eat it and go away. And then tomorrow he'll come back with bear brother, bear sister, bear cousin. Now you got five bears. I can't do it. I got to give in. I give him more food. Great. Okay, now next day you got 15 bears there. Oscar Wilde said, I can resist anything but temptation. But if you give in to temptation, you're just going to cause more temptation later. So what do you do? Here's what you can do. Don't fight it. Don't say, I'm not going to think about it. I'm not going to think about it. I'm not going to think about it. That's not going to work. It's called the ironic rebound effect, right? If you say, I'm not going to think about white bears, I'm not going to think about white bears, you're going to start thinking about white bears. So you don't fight it. But also you don't feed it, you know, just give in and say, oh, I just have to, I give in. No, you just wait. You just wait. Think about the campground. If you don't feed the bear and you don't fight the bear, you just wait. The bear's going to wander around, sniff around, look around, no food here, and then wander away. And that's true of temptation also. There's no temptation that we ever are going to have that is just nonstop lasting forever. And the reason is that human consciousness is not built that way. Even if we try to focus on just one thing, we just cannot continuously, for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours, focus just on one thing. The human mind is naturally restless. This shows up if you ever try to pray. You sit down to pray, okay, God, here I am, I'm praying. And then, oh yeah, I'm thinking about lunch and tomorrow and last week and not praying anymore, right? Your mind naturally wanders away. Now, this is not good news when you're praying, and it's not good news when you're studying. If you ever sit down to study, you're like, I gotta learn this stuff. Pretty soon you're thinking about football or whatever. So the nature of the human mind is wandering is a hindrance when you're trying to pray or trying to study. On the other hand, it's a help if you're tempted. It is 100% certain if you don't give in, and also you don't try to say, I'm not going to think about it, I'm not going to think about it, and you just wait, it will go away. It doesn't feel like it's going to go away. It feels like the wave of temptation is going to get just bigger and bigger and bigger. But in fact, all waves do crash. And most temptations crash and sooner rather than later, within 5 minutes in most cases. So knowing that gives you a huge advantage because you might feel in the moment like, oh, this is the only way to get rid of this is to give in. Not true. Not true. It will go away on its own if you don't give in to it. So those are little tips I learned from positive psychology about how to strengthen weakness of will so that we can be better than we were before. And so I guess I can bring the lecture today to a close just with one last insight, and that is from Aquinas. Aquinas said that there are two kinds of happiness, what he called imperfect happiness that we can have in this life and perfect happiness. And he thought perfect happiness is reserved for the life to come. We could not have perfect happiness here below. And part of the reason for that is that the fragility of our bodies impedes perfect happiness, because we could always get sick and die, and that makes it less than perfect. And our love for God is not perfected here on earth. And so perfect happiness is for the life to come. And this is very good news, because one way to be less happy than we could be is to have unrealistic expectations. If we're thinking, oh, it's always going to be perfect, it'll be perfect, and then we're just going to be continuously disappointed our whole lives. Human life is never going to be perfect. Your life is not going to be perfect, my life's not going to be perfect, and that's okay. That's okay. We're going to be more happy if we don't have these unrealistic expectations. So, thanks for being here to listen to the talk, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions any of you may have.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.